Hello, and thank you for joining the American Revolution. Today, episode 108, The French Connection. One of the arguments for declaring independence in July 1776 was the hope of encouraging foreign assistance for the war effort. Since local production in America would never meet demand, Congress would have to make alliances overseas that would facilitate an international arms trade. The problem with that was that any country that would engage in such a trade would incur the wrath of Britain and would likely have to go to war with Britain. America's best bet for an ally in Europe was France, which of course seemed to be at war with Britain more often than not over the prior century or two. The former British colonists would have to move past their gut reaction of hating the French. New Englanders, especially, had grown up hating the French and going to war with French colonists for most of their lives, as well as the lives of their parents and grandparents. Most British colonists thought the French monarch, King Louis XVI, was even worse than King George III when it came to guaranteeing the rights of his subjects. The language barrier and the fact that the French were all Catholics did not help much either. But going under the theory that the enemy of my enemy is my friend, Congress reached out to France to see if they could find a mutually beneficial arrangement. Back in March 1776, Congress sent Silas Deane to France to see what he could do about a French alliance. For more on that, go back and listen to episode 83. Deane had been a delegate from Connecticut to the Continental Congress, but did not speak French and had never been to Europe before. I'm not sure that he had ever even left the colonies. Deane was the son of a blacksmith. He received a good education, well, as good as you can get from a local school like Yale College, and became a lawyer. He married the widow of a wealthy trader, which may have given him the opportunity to travel to the West Indies. We're just not clear on that. But he had no diplomatic experience, nor much of any idea how he was going to sail across the Atlantic Ocean and convince the King of France to form an alliance and support American independence. Fortunately for Deane, others had already been reaching out to France and getting the ministry at Versailles to start thinking about what it could do to make Britain's situation more miserable in America. One of those men was Arthur Lee. Lee was a Virginian who had lived most of his adult life in Britain. Actually, much of his childhood, too, since he got shipped off to a British boarding school at age 11. He studied medicine at the University of Edinburgh and studied law in London. He had been practicing law in London since about 1770. Lee's entry into British society came from the fact that he was from one of the most prominent and wealthy families in Virginia. He was the brother of Richard Henry Lee, who had been a delegate to the First and Second Continental Congresses. In fact, Arthur had four brothers who served either in the Continental Congress or the Virginia House of Burgesses. A fifth brother had also moved to Britain and served as an alderman for the City of London. As I said, Arthur Lee had a legal practice in London. There he had also been an outspoken advocate for colonial rights in the years leading up to the war. He wrote radical articles not only about colonial rights, but also as an anti-slavery advocate. Lee had become involved with committees of correspondence, writing regularly to Samuel Adams in the years leading up to the war, providing information on how London was reacting to colonial resistance. Lee also knew Benjamin Franklin while Franklin was living in London before he returned to America in 1775. Despite his pedigree, Lee had a proclivity for paranoia and backstabbing. Part of this may have been from the fact that his older brothers had cheated him out of his inheritance when his father died and while he was still a child. Lee still had a working relationship with his powerful and influential brothers, but he developed a cynicism at an early age that everyone is out for themselves and you should probably screw others before they can screw you. Although Franklin went out of his way to assist Lee with his career in London, Lee never seemed to trust nor even respect Franklin. Instead, he seemed to want to trample over Franklin and push him out of the way. Franklin held several colonial representative positions in London that Lee wanted for himself. When Franklin returned to America, Lee took over many of these roles and took an active role in courting other Englishmen in support of protecting colonial rights. Back in early 1775, Lee had attended a dinner party at John Wilkes's home. Remember that Wilkes was a radical Whig on very bad terms with the king and a strong supporter of colonial rights. He did have a popular following in Britain and was at the time Lord Mayor of London. At Wilkes's dinner party, Lee met French playwright Pierre-Augustin de Caron, better known by his stage name Beaumarchais. The party happened shortly after word of Lexington and Concord had reached London. The outbreak of a shooting war in New England was a hot topic of conversation. Beaumarchais had been in town for some time to do some dirty work for King Louis. A French spy in London had been threatening to release papers showing that France had planned an invasion of England a few years earlier. It turns out that the spy, who had been a French soldier for many years, and who even disguised himself as a woman to perform a covert mission in Russia years earlier, might actually be a woman. No one was really sure until after this person's death. The story of this person, Charles Chevalier de Lyon de Beaumont, is a fascinating story in itself, especially if you're interested in transgender historical figures. But I don't want to get too distracted from the story at hand. Beaumarchais had led the life of a French aristocrat wannabe who never quite made it. He had been a tutor to King Louis XV's daughters and used that relationship to form a close relationship with a wealthy man of influence named Joseph Paris Duvernay. Paris Duvernay had been a successful arms merchant. The two men formed a close relationship. Some evidence indicates they were homosexual lovers, even though Paris Duvernay was about 50 years older than Beaumarchais. After the death of Paris Duvernay in 1770, Beaumarchais found himself the subject of lawsuits and criminal prosecution for fraud. Of course, at the time, France did not recognize homosexual relationships, and Paris Duvernay had given many gifts to Beaumarchais that it was kind of hard to Beaumarchais to explain outside of such a very close relationship between the two men. He obviously couldn't use that as a defense because being a homosexual was, of course, a capital offense in France at the time. As a result, Beaumarchais received none of Paris Duvernay's estate and actually had to pay back many of the gifts that Paris Duvernay had given to Beaumarchais over his lifetime. Still, in 1775, Beaumarchais hoped to get back in the king's favor by helping the king with this transgender spy, Dion, who was in London threatening to release documents that might bring Britain and France into another war. So that's the background that led Beaumarchais to meet Arthur Lee in London at a dinner party at the home of John Wilkes. The two men immediately began working out a plan to funnel arms covertly from France to America. Neither Beaumarchais nor Lee seemed concerned with the fact that neither of them had any authorization from the home country to do anything. Lee considered himself a secret agent working on behalf of the Continental Congress. In fact, Congress had done nothing more than send him a letter asking if there were others in London who were friendly to the cause and with whom they should be corresponding. Beaumarchais only had a very unofficial and covert request from the French ministry to deal with the De Lyon affair before it became a public scandal. Nothing more. But unofficially, Lee had the close connections with the Continental Congress, and Beaumarchais was an experienced arms dealer with at least some contacts in the French Foreign Ministry. The two men began working out plans to create a private company in France that would purchase arms, then smuggle them across the Atlantic Ocean to the Continental Army. America would pay for the arms with Virginia tobacco. Both men seemed to think that they would make a fortune in commissions from all these transactions. Their secret plans did not remain secret very long. Although Arthur Lee tended to be very paranoid, one of the few men he took into his confidence was a man named Paul Wentworth, who seems to have made a living as a con man. Wentworth almost immediately sold the information of this deal to the British ministry, meaning London knew about the plot before anyone in Philadelphia or Versailles knew about it. The British did not break up the cabal, though. Instead, they continued to use Wentworth as their inside man so that they could keep tabs on what was happening. For much of the next year, Lee and Beaumarchais continued their talks, hatching plans to covertly trade arms for tobacco, making both of them rich. Beaumarchais began lobbying the French ministry at Versailles, excited at the idea of getting in on the ground floor of a major covert arms operation. All he had to do was convince the government to start a major covert arms operation and then figure out how to become the key figure to run it. He began by sending several proposals to King Louis. In his correspondence, Beaumarchais argued that France had a self-interest in supporting the colonial rebellion in America. At the time, the rebellion had become a major distraction for Britain. But eventually, one of three things would happen. Either Britain would crush the rebellion and then have more time, money, and resources to capture French colonies in the West Indies. A cash-strapped Britain would need these colonies to pay off its debts from the French and Indian War. A second possibility was that Britain and its colonies would come to a settlement, in which case their combined military power could be used to take French colonies in the West Indies. A settlement with North American colonies meant Britain could not raise revenue there, so they could raise it by exploiting former French colonies in the West Indies. Third, and this was probably the least likely, the colonies could win independence, in which case they would become a new power in America and could also threaten, you guessed it, French colonies in the West Indies. Therefore, it was in France's best interest to keep the dispute between Britain and its American colonies going for as long as possible. This would divert British attention and resources towards securing the North American colonies and not give it time or resources to think about acquiring others. An extended rebellion lasting years would weaken Britain and improve France's relative position against its age-old enemy. On the other hand, if Britain found out that France was meddling in this rebellion, it would consider that an act of war. Britain and France would find themselves in yet another expensive war, and Britain could use that war as an excuse to seize more, yes, French colonies in the West Indies. France really did not want to start another war, but if they could provide a little covert assistance to North America, that could help keep Britain distracted, which would be to France's benefit. French Foreign Minister Charles Grévier, Comte de Vergennes, did not even pass along Beaumarchais' proposals to the king, nor did he allow Beaumarchais to be granted an audience with the king. Starting covert military aid was a dangerous game. Besides, Vergennes wanted Beaumarchais to focus on cleaning up the D'Eon spy affair in order to prevent that war with Britain, not hatch a whole new arms deal that could start a different war with Britain. Even if cautious, though, Vergennes saw the possible benefits of distracting Britain in an ongoing rebellion. Recall that in late 1775, Vergennes had very quietly sent Bonvillars to Philadelphia to speak very unofficially with the Continental Congress and get an idea what was going on there. I discussed that in more detail back in episode 71. Vergennes received inflated reports from both Bonvillars and Beaumarchais that Washington had amassed an army of nearly 40,000, with thousands more in militia available to back him up. Of course, Washington had nowhere near these numbers, but since Vergennes had nothing else to go on, he saw the rebellion as a credible problem for the British. In March 1776, Vergennes began to raise the issue with the king and some other top officials. Small amounts of aid that could not be traced back to the French government might prolong the rebellion and weaken Britain. France had already begun rebuilding its army and navy, but was not ready for war now. At some point, war with Britain was inevitable, but the American distraction could delay that war and could also weaken Britain when war finally came. After some debate, King Louis decided in May to provide some covert assistance. Beaumarchais created a trading company called Rodriguez Hortelès and Company. This would be a front for the covert arms smuggling that France was considering. Vergennes had convinced the king that it was in France's best interest to prolong the fighting in America in order to sap the military and economic strength of Britain. But as I said, France had no interest in American independence, and certainly did not want to promote the idea that it was okay for subjects to engage in an armed rebellion against a king if they did not like his policies. But if America became more of a distraction for the British over the next few years, that would be just fine. The French ministry indirectly gave 1 million livres, about $8 million in modern inflation-adjusted currency, to the Rodriguez Hortelès and Company. Later, they would get the King of Spain to kick in another million, and would raise a third million from private investors. Beaumarchais would use about half the money to purchase used arms all over Europe, and use the other half to establish credit for the Americans. When the Americans shipped tobacco in exchange, the money would be repaid and returned to the various investors. Now, all of this was already in play before anyone in Europe knew that Silas Deane was still slowly making his way across the Atlantic. Congress had appointed Deane in March 1776. He did not arrive in France until June, and then it took him another month to reach Paris in July. Deane's cover story was that he was a private trader looking for commercial opportunities in France. As soon as he stepped off the ship, British agents began tailing him, suspecting he was up to no good. Congress had provided Deane with a few contacts in France and some letters of introduction. One was for Edward Bancroft, a Massachusetts-born doctor then living in London. Bancroft and Franklin had known each other in London. There is also some evidence that Deane and Bancroft already knew each other. Some records suggest that Bancroft was a student of Deane's when Deane was a schoolteacher in Connecticut. Deane wrote to Bancroft in London and asked him to come visit him in Paris, sending him travel money. Bancroft agreed to help, and the two men met with Jacques Barbeau Duberg, a French arms dealer. Duberg, in turn, arranged a meeting with Vergennes in the Foreign Ministry. Vergennes took the meeting, although he moved it away from the main offices of the Foreign Ministry to an isolated location where he hoped there would be little attention. The cautious Vergennes did not reveal to any of the men at the meeting that the king had already decided to provide covert assistance. Instead, he told them that France was obligated to remain neutral and could not assist them. However, Vergennes did suggest that Deane meet with a private arms merchant named Beaumarchais, who now ran the large trading firm of Rodriguez Hortelès and Company. Duberg told Deane later not to contact Beaumarchais, who was mostly known for writing plays like The Barber of Seville and The Marriage of Figaro. He was not a player in the international arms trade, nor even known much as a merchant at all. So Deane decided not to speak with Beaumarchais and continued to work with Duberg. A few weeks later, Vergennes again suggested that Deane speak with Beaumarchais. This time, Deane took the hint and set up a meeting. Of course, Beaumarchais, who was secretly financed with the king's money, offered Deane extremely generous terms of credit and promised boatloads of supplies to be shipped in short order. The two men worked out all the details, with Bancroft acting as translator. A few weeks after making the initial arrangements, and with Beaumarchais busily making purchases and filling up ships to send to America, Bancroft returned to London. Deane offered Bancroft £300 sterling a year to help keep track of what was happening in London and for any intelligence that he could provide. Shortly after his arrival in London, Bancroft met with the British Foreign Ministry and told them everything that Deane and Beaumarchais were doing in France. Bancroft accepted an offer of £500 sterling a year from the British government to continue spying on Deane's activities in France. So the double agent was collecting a nice salary from both sides. The British had an inside man into everything France was doing to funnel arms to America. However, they could not confront France without jeopardizing their source. For now, they would simply collect intelligence and wait for an opportunity to use it. So, despite British knowledge of the arms trade from the very beginning, French assistance began to flow to America. By August 1776, Rodrigue Hortalez had purchased about 200 tons of gunpowder, 20,000 small arms, and a number of cannon, mortars, and other equipment needed in America. The company had considerable trouble with shipments making it to port, as British spies were informing French police, who had to stop these illegal shipments. The British ambassador to France, Lord Stormont, complained directly to Vergennes about the operation. Vergennes, of course, denied any involvement. He was shocked that illegal arms smuggling was going on, and he promised to look right into that matter. The ambassador knew Vergennes was lying, since he had Bancroft giving him all the details. But because the British were not ready to reveal their source, they kept their complaints vague. Aside from the British, Dubourg, upset about being cut out of the deals, began attacking Beaumarchais as a con artist who was enriching himself without the ability to deliver on his promises. Arthur Lee, who was upset about being cut out of the arms deals as well, became even more of a problem. He started bad-mouthing Dean to his friends and family in the Continental Congress. He then traveled to Paris to see if he could still get involved in the deals now moving forward. Among other things, Lee created a list of Americans whom he considered disloyal to the Patriot cause, including several members of the Continental Congress. Lee wanted Dean to send this list to Congress. Dean refused, saying he was not going to defame the reputation of good men on speculation without solid proof. For Lee, this seemed to indicate that Dean was part of a conspiracy to destroy the Patriot cause. Despite making all these enemies, and despite the obstructive efforts of British spies Dubourg and Lee, Dean and Beaumarchais began shipping much-needed supplies to America. Next week, New York City burns, and the British hang a spy named Nathan Hale. Hi, thanks for joining the American Revolution Podcast After Show. I want to thank one of the show's Robert Morris Circle supporters on Patreon. Tyson Franz runs a site called Liberty & Co. He sells a wide range of products with American Revolution themes. So if you're looking for t-shirts, magnets, candles, mugs, etc., this is a great place to find a product with an American Revolution or Constitution theme. I was checking out some of the candles the other day on the site. They're all hand-poured and come with some really unique scents related to the Revolution. For example, the We the People candle smells like parchment, and of course the Boston Tea Party candle smells like Bohai tea. It's a great way to engage your nose in the Revolution as you listen to my podcast. If you want to buy something on the site, Tyson has offered a 20% discount on anything if you use the promo code AMREV, that's AMREV, at checkout on the site. You can get to the site at libertyand.co. I've also added a link to libertyand.co on my website, amrevpodcast.com. Today's episode focused on France in the second half of 1776. Silas Deane was pretty much on his own in France with no diplomatic experience, nor few other skills to succeed in his goals. Deane is one of those people you don't hear much about. Of course, Benjamin Franklin gets all the credit for involving France in the American cause when he arrives 6 months after Deane. As we will hear in a future episode, Franklin's fame preceded him and gave him many opportunities that Deane did not have. Deane also gets criticized later in the war for allegedly trying to profit fraudulently from the arms trade that he began. I'll admit that I have not found as much detail on this topic as I would like. Some writers say there is some justification to these allegations, but my impression so far is that these allegations were false, or at the very least greatly exaggerated, to move him out of the way and allow Arthur Lee to take over the contracts. The Continental Army did hold hearings on the allegations, something I'll probably address in a future episode, but they found nothing. Unfortunately, they could not completely exonerate him either, since France seized most of the records of his dealings and refused to release them for fear the British would get them. So, no complete exoneration from Congress. Where have we heard that before? Dean also drew some controversy near the end of the war after Yorktown when some of his personal letters were made public. He had expressed concerns about whether an independent U.S. could really make it on its own, and made some other rather pessimistic thoughts about the war effort. He then died rather suddenly and suspiciously as he attempted to return to America, again something I really want to cover in a future episode. I'm mentioning all this now because it means that Dean never really did get the praise and adulation that many other founding fathers did. His work in Europe was always covered by a cloud of ethics accusation, and much of it was kept secret. Ben Franklin got all the credit for the success of France, and Dean died before he could have any post-war political career to rehabilitate his reputation. So when I went looking for a good biography on Dean, there just wasn't much out there. However, while looking for that elusive biography, I did come across this week's book recommendation. It's called Unlikely Allies: How a Merchant, a Playwright, and a Spy Saved the Revolution by Joel Richard Paul. The book looks at the lives of three people, the merchant, Silas Dean, the playwright, Beaumarchais, and the spy, the Chevalier d'Eon. They all had stories that interacted and played a role in bringing France into the war on the side of the Patriots. D'Eon is the transgender spy that I mentioned in today's episode. The book goes into much more detail than I did about this person's life. While the impact on the revolution by this person was only indirect, the story is an interesting one and definitely worth reading. The book was first published in 2009 and is over 400 pages. The author, Paul, is a law professor specializing in international law. Now, thankfully, the book is not as dry as you might think from a law professor. In fact, I found it to be an easy and enjoyable read. Paul has also more recently written a book about Chief Justice John Marshall. His book, Unlikely Allies, does a great job covering the early American diplomatic efforts in France. So, since today is all about France, my online recommendation this week is going to be the French History Podcast, which you can find at www.thefrenchhistorypodcast.com. This podcast covers the very long history of France, beginning actually in prehistory. Gary Girard does a great job with what looks to be a very long project. At present, he's still going through the Roman era, so it may be years before it reaches the era of the American Revolution. But if you're interested in French history, you may want to check out this podcast. It's available on all major platforms or from www.thefrenchhistorypodcast.com. Well, that's all for this week. I hope you will join me again next week for another American Revolution podcast.